Good morning. The first case on the docket this morning is United States v. Davis. Are the parties ready? Okay, we'll hear first from the appellant.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Scott Martin, and together with my co-counsel, Captain Joshua Fix, I represent the appellant in this case, Private Joshua Davis. Since deciding Taylor 29 years ago, this court has had multiple opportunities to revisit that decision. On each and every one of those occasions, this court has applied the Taylor standard. Thus, contrary to the Army Corps' opinion, Taylor has not been overturned. And for the following two simple reasons, this court should not overturn Taylor here today. First, Taylor is well-settled law. And second, the Taylor standard is perfectly suited to the situation in which a military judge fails to act on his sua sponte duty to instruct on an affirmative defense, the defense here being the mistake of fact as to consent. Starting with the first point, Taylor is well-settled law. It's so well-settled, in fact, that the government argued for the applicability of Taylor in this very case before the Army Court. Now, the Army Court dismisses Taylor and his progeny as the occasional precedent to the contrary, but neither the Army Court nor the government has identified one single case in which this court applied forfeiture to the situation in which a military judge failed to act on his sua sponte duty to instruct on an affirmative defense. And it should be noted that when this court decided Taylor 29 years ago, it wasn't novel law at the time either. The court in Taylor noted that at least since Ginn was decided in 1952, this court was not aware of any case when forfeiture had been applied to a situation like this. So for 65 years, this has been well settled. Why then now at the second stage level of appellate review does the government take issue with the case? Well, they offer three reasons in their brief. First, the government points to the waiver provision of RCM 920F. But that's the exact same argument the government made 30 years ago when they raised it in Taylor. And it's the exact same argument that this court rejected 30 years ago when it decided Taylor. Nothing has changed about RCM 920F between then and now. The government next argues that Article 51C, UCMJ, is somehow irrelevant today because we have military judges, whereas when Taylor was decided, the article referred more likely to panel presidents and law officers. But it is not at all obvious how the identity of the person giving an instruction would somehow change the contents required in those instructions, and the government does not make that connection in its brief.
Why should you get a better rule for instructions than you do for constitutional error?
Could you give me an example, Your Honor, please?
The rule that you want us to use is what?
A de novo review, Your Honor. Look to whether or not the military judge should have instructed based on the evidence.
Why wouldn't it be plain error?
Your Honor, this has been the standard, as I mentioned, for 65 years.
What I'm saying is if it was a constitutional error, right, that you failed to object to at all, what standard would we use?
Well, that depends, Your Honor. And the difference here, and the reason why this is the right standard, is because the right to this instruction, the accused right to this instruction at trial, attaches at the point that some evidence is introduced. At that point, the military judge has a sua sponte duty to instruct on that element. It's completely independent of whether or not an appellant asks for that instruction.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? It's basically so because we said it was so. Why now, when we've largely jettisoned the notion that this court should basically obviate waiver and forfeiture in the interest of somehow protecting the troop from badly trained counsel, or no counsel, which was the case in the early days of the code, why do we need to single these defenses out now?
Your Honor, the difference here is that a defense counsel and an accused are under no obligation to request this instruction. There's been a policy.
That's what we said, but I'm asking you why.
You've said it, Your Honor. The President has said it in RCM 920E3, and this court has held that it's reflected in the statutory language of Article 51C. Now, there are good policy reasons for that, Your Honor. The reason is that the military judge is by far the most experienced military justice practitioner in the courtroom. And as a secondary matter, the military judge, unlike the defense counsel, is not wed to any particular theory of the case. He's the neutral arbiter in the room. He's the one best situated to hear the evidence and spot any potential defenses that may have been raised. And that's been reflected.
Well, then why don't you just treat all defenses on the same basis? They've got to be raised or they're forfeited. Or waived if the circumstances are proper.
I may be misunderstanding your question, Your Honor, but I'm not arguing that the defense here is deserving of special treatment. I believe this is the correct standard for all special and affirmative defenses, and that's been this court's holding now for 65 years. And the reason for that, again, is because the question in these cases on appeal is not, would the appellant have been entitled to it had he asked for it? The right question to ask is, in light of the evidence, should the instruction have been given? And that's reflected in the Taylor standard. It asks two simple questions. Should this have been given in light of the evidence? And if it wasn't given, does it matter?
Okay, let me back up then. Was there any evidence here? Or can we just decide this on the basis that there's nothing here? It wasn't raised. Why?
There was evidence, Your Honor, and even
I don't see any evidence, but it say so.
There was evidence, Your Honor, and even the Army Court acknowledged there was evidence, and that is when confronted with this allegation of the sexual assault, my client said, "I thought she was kidding until she started crying," and that's entirely consistent with the alleged victim's version of the assault, which is that she was assaulted, and when she started crying, he stopped. And the Army Court itself wrote that there's credit to a degree to that interpretation. So the Army Court did precisely what judges are not supposed to do in these cases. It made a credibility assessment. It said there is some credit here, but we find that this alternative version more credible.
Wait a minute. They do factual sufficiency every day. They have to. That includes credibility.
Perhaps I spoke too broadly, Your Honor, but in determining whether or not an instruction on an affirmative or special defense should be given, judges are not supposed to conduct a credibility assessment. The standard is they look whether or not there's some evidence from any source that the panel members could believe if they so chose, and any doubt as to whether or not the defense should be given should be resolved in favor of giving the instruction. It's a low standard. It essentially takes all discretion away from the military judge in that once that threshold has been met, the military judge has a sua sponte obligation to give the instruction. And frankly, forfeiture is the wrong standard to apply in this case because it drives a wedge between the point at which a service member is entitled to the defense or the instruction on the defense and the point at which appellate courts are willing to test for harmlessness. And what I mean by that is that a service member is entitled to this instruction absent a request if there is some evidence of it. Yet under the Army Court standard, appellate courts will only do something about it and test for harmlessness if the defense clearly and obviously raised the defense. And it does not make sense to drive that wedge and, in effect, punish the service member, the appellant, when he was under no obligation to ask for the instruction.
Captain Martin, the fact of the matter is that over these many decades now, there's no reason to think or an argument to be made that the current case law is unworkable, is it?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, and I think that's reflected with the infrequency with which these cases make it to this level. There have been a number of cases, but it's approximately every 4 to 5 years that they reach to this level, so that would suggest that this rule is working phenomenally well in the field. And as I mentioned in my brief, if this rule were to change, a lot of these errors would be shifted to IAC allegations for a defense counsel failing to raise it.
Isn't that what it is, right? I mean,
no, Your Honor, because
yes, it is. I mean, if the military judge has a sui sponte duty to do something and they fail to do it, and the defendant, nonetheless, their counsel, sees that this defense should have been raised and they don't raise it and they don't ask the military judge for the instruction, they don't seek to have it corrected, and then you want us to just do it something about it.
Well, I think the starting point, Your Honor, the starting question is whose responsibility was it to get this right in the first place?
Right, it says that the military judge has a responsibility duty to do it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
A duty to do a lot of things. And how do we review their failure to do them?
And
there's no objection.
As a starting point, Your Honor, I would say
if there's
this.
No objection.
Yes, and I would, as a starting point, say this is not a case of first impression. This has been well settled for 65 years.
Well, but it's not been followed uniformly.
I believe it has, Your Honor. And what I mean by that is the government has cited cases where an instruction has been given. And then subsequent to that, the appellant on appeal has said that wasn't the right instruction or there was something wrong about it. And some of those cases have been treated or analyzed for forfeiture. But there is not a single case in which the military judge has wholesalely omitted a required instruction on an affirmative defense or a special defense that has been treated for forfeiture. And I can list the cases. It's Taylor in 1988. It's Brown in 1995. It's unrelated Davis in 2000. It's McDonald in 2002. It's Stanley in 2012. And I know this isn't a persuasive or binding argument, but I think it just goes to show this isn't some antiquated rule. When this case affirmatively endorsed and embraced the Taylor standard in Stanley in 2012, that's the same year that the misconduct in this case was taking place. So I'm not arguing that there's some sort of retroactivity or ex post facto issue going on here, but it does highlight the fact that the Taylor standard is not some antiquated standard that hasn't been applied in years. It's been applied consistently, has been applied since 1965, and it's been applied recently. And going back to your question, Your Honor, not only is this well working, but we've just seen the 2017 NDAA, which has been called the most comprehensive reform of the UCMJ in three decades. And as this court has said, as I've said, Taylor's well-settled law. The root of that is 51C. Had Congress wanted to change that, they had every opportunity. They did a line-by-line review, and they did not change this rule. They did not change 51C in any way that would affect the reasoning that this court reached in Taylor 29 years ago. For those reasons, I would ask that this case be reversed and remanded to the Army Court so that the Army Court can conduct its statutorily required Article 66 review, applying the proper standard.
Let me ask you. Go ahead.
This isn't how it's treated in the civilian world, is it?
No, Your Honor. Is there a
reason why we should treat it differently than the issue is treated in every other court in the country?
Yeah, I can give you three reasons, Your Honor. The first is Article 51C. There's no counterpart in the civilian world. The second reason is that there's been a recognition by this court that our practitioners, our trial practitioners, tend to bring a little bit less experience to the table than their civilian counterparts. And again, that's a policy reason why it makes sense to have the military judge sitting as the most experienced member in the courtroom be the one who's responsible for spotting and instructing upon this. And I know I said three reasons, Your Honor, but those are two.
Thank you, Governor Perry. You can bring up the third one on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And again, I would simply ask that this be remanded so that he can receive his proper Article 66 review. I'm going to cite a case which I don't think was cited. I can sub-cite it at the court request, but that's exactly what the court did last term in Gifford when it found that the Army Court had applied the wrong standard. Rather than just resolving the problem at this level, the court remanded it so that the appellant could have a proper Article 66 review. And that's what I would ask for here. Pending any further questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Tara O'Brien-Goble, and along with Major Michael Cordy, I represent the United States. Appellant is not entitled to relief in this case for two reasons. First, the Army Court did not abuse its discretion in applying plain error review. And second, to the extent this court believes Taylor stands for the proposition that affirmative defenses should have a heightened standard of review, absent objection, as compared to other mandatory instructions, this court should expressly overrule Taylor. Turning to the first point, the Army Court properly applied this court's case law and the standard of review applicable to mandatory instructions. In doing so, its reasoning was sound in finding that post-Taylor cases have eroded and undermined its applicability.
Well, what did it do with Taylor specifically? Did it ignore it? Did it overrule it? How did it deal with it?
Your Honor, it treated Taylor as though Taylor has been implicitly overruled by the post-Taylor case law dealing with mandatory instructions. For instance, in United States versus Eckhoff that same year in 1988, this court dealt with another mandatory instruction dealing with an affirmative defense of entrapment, and the court applied a plain error review. The court also looked to at least 12 other cases post-Taylor dealing with mandatory instructions where the court applied a plain error review. And since Taylor, this court has reviewed at least 14 cases involving mandatory instructions without objection for plain error, at least four of which dealt with affirmative defenses. And while the defense counsel noted that the instructions were given in those cases, there was no differentiation made in when an instruction is given, but it's the entirely wrong instruction, and no instruction is given at all. The court in Eckhoff stated that when there is no objection, we will review for plain error.
Well, it's not uncommon for appellate courts over the years, particularly with longstanding rules, to kind of wobble sometimes in their following of those rules. And it seems to me your best argument would be that the rule that Taylor is known to stand for now was wrong. And I think that's part of your argument in your brief.
Certainly, Your Honor. First of all, like you mentioned, throughout the course of time since Taylor, it appears that at least as it relates to mandatory instructions not involving affirmative defenses, this court has applied a plain error review. And looking at affirmative defenses, this court has stated that a plain error review applies to all mandatory instructions.
Well, let's go back first. One of the reasons that you're asking us to overturn it is because it was poorly reasoned. And it was based to a large degree on our finding in United States versus Ginn, that 1952 case. So are you asking us to overrule Ginn as well? Because that is the basis for Taylor, the way I understand it.
Well, Your Honor, in Ginn, the court was dealing, first of all, with the law officer. And in that case, the court was also dealing with all mandatory instructions, as this court has already essentially said that elements, reasonable doubt, and lesser-included offenses will be reviewed de novo. So I guess to the extent that it stands for the same proposition, yes.
So Ginn and all of its progeny would be overruled as well?
Only to the extent that it stands for the proposition that you're going to review de novo mandatory instructions when they're not objected to. And that is why the government would ask that you overrule Taylor if you find that the Army Court did abuse its discretion. In so much as Taylor doesn't have any continuing applicability, and it was poorly reasoned in so much as it relied on Article 51C, which, as acknowledged in our brief and the Army Court's case, doesn't even deal with affirmative defenses. That specifically lays out elements, reasonable doubt, and discusses lesser-included offenses, as discussed, all of which this court has already continued to review for plain error. Moreover, this court has called Taylor into question on at least two different occasions. In 1995, in United States versus Brown, this court signaled that it would consider overruling Taylor if the court was presented with brief and argument, which it is today. And in 2014, in United States versus Davis, this court noted that while plain error may have been the appropriate standard of review in that case, because the government didn't articulate that as the standard, the court was not going to address whether it was the appropriate standard of review. So based on this court's continuing case law dealing with mandatory instructions, not affirmative defenses, and this court's recent decision in United States versus Payne, where this court interpreted Article 51C as relied on by Taylor and the defense, the court stated that Article 51C was not mutually exclusive with a plain error review, in so much as, of course, a military judge will retain a sua sponte duty to instruct on defenses, but absent objection, those will still be reviewed for plain error. And while that case dealt with elements, that should be considered the same as an affirmative defense, as both are mandatory instructions.
Well, I'm not sure how that works. If there is some evidence of an affirmative defense, and if the military judge has failed to instruct on it, given our case law, isn't that plain error? That's error anyway, any way you look at it. De novo, plain error, obvious error?
Depending on the circumstances, Your Honor, and plain error would not be mutually exclusive with a de novo review, in so much as this court will still look at whether there was error de novo. So whether the instruction should have been given is reviewed de novo. However, then the court goes to the next step. Was that error plain and obvious? And in certain circumstances, it may be that some evidence was raised, but it was not plain and obvious. For instance, in a case like this, and it's the government's position that some evidence was not even raised, but let's say some evidence was raised in a case like this, but the entire defense strategy was that it did not happen, and it was only one sentence within the entire court's martial, and the military judge is certainly in the best position to assess what is happening and assess whether or not the evidence was raised. There, it probably would not be plain and obvious, but it would still allow, a plain error review certainly still allows the appellant the benefit of a review, so it's not entirely waived, and in circumstances where the defense was, it was consensual, and the military judge did not give that instruction, it was plain and obvious, absolutely. And that is why plain error is the appropriate standard in this case, as plain error is the standard used in all constitutional cases, for instance, Fourth Amendment violations, remarks on the right to remain silent, all evidentiary instructions, and everything else we review. It's also consistent with the civilian world and the way they treat instructional errors, in so much as there may be reasons that the defense don't request an instruction, and that should be reviewed based on the circumstances as they arise.
Is it the government's position, I think you just said, that this in fact wasn't raised, that there was no evidence?
Your Honor, the government's position is that there was no evidence as to a reasonable mistake of fact.
Right, that's what I'm asking.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So
now you're asking us to basically chop down 30 years of precedent when we could decide this case on the narrow ground that it wasn't even raised.
Well, you could easily decide this case in so much as even under a de novo review, it was not raised.
It was not raised. Bye-bye.
And TJAG didn't certify an issue for us.
Yeah, so
is it that issue that...
Why don't we just decide it on that?
You could, Your Honor, but as the issue in front of the court was whether it was the appropriate standard of review.
I know that, but I'm asking that. The government's position is there was no evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. But even still, we would ask that this court consider expressly overruling Taylor for the reasons stated. And going back to Article 920F, looked to in United States versus Payne, this court has essentially implicitly done so. And based on all of those reasons, the government would ask that this court look at all of the case law post-Taylor and the fact that mandatory instructions have consistently been reviewed either de novo or for plain error. And as a result, because of the number that have been reviewed for plain error, the government would ask that you do expressly overrule Taylor and also find that the Army Corps did not abuse its discretion.
Is it the government's position that as a historical matter, we have sort of ignored Taylor in a lapse or a fit of inattention or something, that we made this pronouncement and then we've blown it off ever since? Because you certainly cite a bunch of cases in which the government seems to say that. I mean, what have we done with Taylor in the intervening 30 years?
It seems that over the past 30 years, your application of Taylor has slowly eroded and you have not applied it, at least in the majority of cases, involving mandatory instructions, especially in so much as Taylor did stand for the premise that mandatory instructions would be reviewed de novo, that would include elements, lesser included offenses, and reasonable doubt, along with affirmative defenses, all of which you have continued to review.
Well, there's also this, partially because of our nomenclature, there are special defenses and affirmative defenses, and God knows what the difference is between the two. That seems to have something to do with some of this.
It appears that you have reviewed affirmative defenses, at least in... In the majority of cases, okay. You've reviewed de novo. There are a few outliers where you have reviewed for plain error. First of all, Ackoff, and then there were three following it, and those were subsided yesterday. But Lanier was affirmed dealing with self-defense, and two others, Martinez, and one other case. None of which dealt with mistake of fact, but all of which dealt with affirmative defenses where an instruction was given, but it was a completely incorrect instruction. So generally, affirmative defenses might be the outliers, but when you do talk about affirmative defenses and the fact that those are reviewed de novo, generally the language is we review mandatory instructions de novo. In 2000 in United States versus Davis, that was the quote used. Again, in United States versus Stanley, a similar quote was used. So it seems to suggest that you're doing so under the premise not that affirmative defenses are different, but that mandatory instructions are reviewed de novo. Pending further questions?
You can briefly summarize.
Because of this court's post-Taylor treatment of the majority of mandatory instructions, this court should find that the Army Court did not abuse its discretion in reviewing for plain error. And to the extent this court finds any continuing applicability of Taylor, this court should expressly overrule that decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Ever your third reason?
I didn't, Your Honor. I apologize for that.
Counsel, as you get started, could you please address the point raised by the government that at trial there was insufficient evidence to raise the issue of the affirmative defense?
And again, Your Honor, I would disagree with that, and I briefly touched upon why, and I would point to the Army Court's opinion as well, where they did find some credit to that version, that what he was talking about was, I thought she was kidding during this sexual interaction, and I stopped when she started crying, and that's consistent with what she testified to, the facts of the sexual assault. I would say that's the evidence, and even the Army Court said there was some a degree of credit. I don't want to misquote them, but they did find something to that. I want to start by saying that Taylor has never been about all instructional error. It's been about affirmative defenses. That's what it's always been about. And even in Taylor, this court noted that not all instructional error is treated the same.
Counsel, isn't it, you want the rule to be the Taylor rule, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though the Taylor rule, as a matter of first impression, makes no sense at all. The statute doesn't say anything about affirmative defenses. And there's good reasons why we want people to make objections at trial, isn't there?
Your Honor.
Help the judge a chance to correct the error.
Your Honor, there are legitimate concerns about sandbagging, and that was identified in Payne. And I would argue that underlies the decision in Payne. There's no evidence of that here. And frankly,
it's not just the sandbagging, right? It's the rule for almost everything, which is you need to object. If you don't object, we'll treat it as forfeited, and we'll review it for plain error.
But that's not the rule here, Your Honor.
But what I'm asking is, what reason is there to treat this small universe of things differently than the whole rest of the world?
First, Your Honor, because of 920E3. It says so. There's a sua sponte duty on the military judge, independent of the appellants. Your Honor, I sense you're not satisfied with that answer.
Well, there's sua sponte duty for the military judge to do many, many things, and review all of them for plain error.
And I can't speak authoritatively on all of those, but I do know here, and for that reason, this has not been tested for forfeiture. And again, it simply does not make sense to punish an appellant at the appellate level for not asking for something that he had no obligation to ask for, that should have been given completely independent of his request.
You're not punishing anybody. If we change the rule, they know what the rule is.
Well, you'd be applying a higher standard, Your Honor.
That's not punishing anybody. I mean, that's silly.
Well, let me rephrase that then. There's no reason to apply a heightened level of review, something higher.
Well, no. I think the problem is not a heightened level of review. The problem is a heightened level of deference for this small universe, as Judge Ryan pointed out. And why should we treat these any differently than anything else in this universe is treated, and differently from every other federal court in the land?
I can only raise the points I already have. It's 51C, it's 920E3, and it's 65 years of precedent. And
but
before you...
About this.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that this court got it right in Taylor. As this court noted in Davis 2014, a special defense is something that the government must prove the non-existence of beyond a reasonable doubt to establish guilt. In that respect, it's very much like an element, in that it must be proven, the absence of it must be proven before the government can establish guilt. And that's why I believe that this court held it in the same category. And finally, Your Honor, I think you hit the nail on the head when you asked, what does plain error mean here? Does it mean that if there's some evidence, there's plain error? Because that's not the approach the Army Court took. The Army Court took the approach. I see I'm over time. May I finish, Your Honor?
You can answer, follow up on the question, and I have one additional question.
The Army Court took the opinion that it's only plain error if the evidence clearly and obviously raises it. So just here you have the Army Court arguing for one plain error standard, the government arguing for a different one. It's not even clear what plain error would mean. So when we talk about only overturning well-settled law if the law is poorly reasoned or unworkable, we don't even know what the new standard would look like. We don't even know what the government's asking you to do. And for that reason, leave 65 years of law in place, Your Honor.
How do you respond to the government's argument that we already have moved away from Taylor and we've applied it inconsistently and invited parties to bring a challenge that we're hearing today?
I would make the point, Your Honor, that... Again, Taylor is about affirmative defenses, and the government has not cited one single case in which a military judge failed to act on his sua sponte duty to give an instruction, and this court applied forfeiture. Now, it's true that the court has dropped footnotes in the past, but in Brown, they said, we would consider overturning this if not for the sua sponte obligation. So this court there recognized that the sua sponte obligation, as I have argued, is what makes this different. Now, in Davis, the court said, or at least alluded to the possibility, Davis 2014, that forfeiture could be the right standard in these cases. But 3 months later, this court decided MacDonald in 2014. And in that case, the defense counsel had requested an instruction, and that request had been imprecise. But the court in a footnote said, we don't need to review what effect, if any, that imprecise request had on the obligation to give this instruction because it's a sua sponte obligation. So in effect, the same, I don't want to say the same act, but a similar act that triggered the analysis in Payne, is this preserved in that case? This court said we don't need to do that analysis when we're dealing with affirmative defenses. And that was only in 2014, 3 years ago, that they said forfeiture, not explicitly, but implicitly held that forfeiture doesn't apply to this type of case. So I would completely disagree with the government's characterization. This court has been incredibly consistent in applying this standard to this type of case. It has treated other cases differently, but it has never treated this type of case differently.
Why is this any different than an LIO?
Like, Your Honor.
It's a sua sponte duty for the military judge to instruct on any LIO that's reasonably raised by the evidence as well, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think...
I've tested those for plain error, I know for a fact, because I've written cases where that's happened.
Most of the cases that the government has cited are different in that an LIO instruction was given, not that it should have been given, but it wasn't. So that would be the directly analogous case. But
why is it better for them to give the wrong instruction as opposed to no instruction? Why do we test one, as a matter of logic, why would we test one for plain error and one de novo?
Well, Your Honor, it goes back to why do we do this in the first place? We do it because there's a sua sponte duty. There's a sua sponte duty to instruct.
You can get it right, isn't well, there?
Your Honor, there's an implicit sua sponte duty to get it right. But I think there is a meaningful difference. And if you allow me to answer, I hope I can highlight that for you. The first is that there's this principle in law that an accused or an appellant is entitled to a fair trial, but not a perfect trial. And therein lies the sua sponte duty. A military judge has to give the instruction. If he doesn't give the instruction, then we apply the de novo review. If he does give some instruction and maybe it's not perfect, in that case, forfeiture applies. And another reason for that is because in that case, the instruction is in black and white in front of the defense counsel. This court can say with certainty that the defense counsel looked at that instruction and approved it, at least implicitly, by not objecting to it. That's completely different from the case at hand here, where there's no indication whatsoever that the defense counsel thought about this, considered it, and decided one way or the other. And that's why the court recognizes a sua sponte duty and applies a de novo review in this case. And I hope I answered your question.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case has now been submitted. The court thanks counsel for both parties, and we will be in recess until 10:20.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:20.